history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty incredible stories out there waiting to be told if we'll take a little time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We definitely want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Nampa, Idaho to meet George Eldridge, and I'm told he's 100 years old, but he sure doesn't look like it. What's your secret, George? A centenarian, and you stand straighter than I do.
It's real simple.
All right.
Just pick your parents and then get an electric toothbrush.
Great advice. I'm sure everybody is lining up to go pick one of those up right now.
Just stay healthy.
Staying healthy, and clearly you've done that. We're going to hear about your 28 years in the Air Force, including time in B-26s in Europe during World War II. But take me back to your childhood in Kansas, Alma, Kansas, between Manhattan and Topeka. How big of a place is that?
About 1,000. County seat, very rural area, mostly pasture, white-faced cattle.
So you're growing up there, the oldest of five kids. What was that childhood like in the 20s and 30s?
It was hard work, walked to school. I did everything on a farm or ranch.
How demanding was that? Do you remember a particular task that you had to carry out on the farm that was the toughest? Milking cows or what?
Milking cows, building fences, mowing hay, stacking hay. Back in the days when they used an old hay stacker.
I know this a long time ago. But do you remember having a dream, an ambition? Maybe it was just to get off the farm, I don't know. But did you have a dream of, hey, when I grow up, I want to do X, Y, Z?
It probably changed during my childhood considerably. I was good at math. I studied accounting. But I got diverted by the occasions of the day. I took some opportunities that I was always on a horse. It came natural to go to a motorcycle. I got a small one, and then I got a larger one. Then I got a factory-made special, and I raced on dirt tracks in eastern Kansas, down as far as Oklahoma or down in Missouri. But I was never real famous as it, but I always qualified.
So you're racing motorcycles on dirt tracks. How safe of an endeavor was that, George?
It was considered so unsafe that when I got in the military, I wanted to be an aviation cadet, and the first thing I had to do was dispose of my motorcycle.
And when we hear about the plane you flew your missions in and its reputation, boy, that's going to put that in perspective, too. I've got to ask you, since you know you are in that part of the country during the Great Depression, and we've heard so many stories about that, was that something that you felt out on the farm? Did you see the effects of this downturn in the country?
Everywhere. The temperature in the summertime was over 100 every day. It was not only hot, but it was dry. And then on top of that, we had grasshoppers. And some of the grasshoppers were 3 inches long. They were the locusts. They can't fly. They're so big and fat. So all they do is eat and just keep walking. And they destroy everything in sight.
Does that include your guys' farm?
Well, they weren't that severe that they destroyed it, but you can find them everywhere.
You mentioned aviation. Was that a bug that you caught early? I mean, do you remember when you first got turned on to this idea of getting up in an airplane and flying around?
I was 10 years old in 1927, and I distinctly remember Lindbergh's exploits. I whittled out wooden propellers and would hit them on a little model airplane. My dad would drive the car. I'd stick the little airplane out in the airflow, and it would roar like a... So my mother just couldn't stand that thing.
So you had a little glimpse of your future right there. What was it, though, that made you decide in 1941 to join the Army Air Corps? Where did that come from? What was your motivation?
I think the prime motivation was a little card I got that said, "Greetings from your friends and fellow countrymen. You have been selected and have the distinct privilege of serving 1 year in the U.S. military, and you will be provided with another dot, 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 dot. Have you ever seen one of those cards?
A little draft notice from Uncle Sam?
Yeah, that's what it was. And I rode a troop train from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas to Central California in 1941.
Where'd you end up in California?
Camp Roberts. And that is up as far as you can get from nowhere. Halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles.
I know that we have some regular listeners there at Camp Roberts who hear this program, so they're out there in Paso Robles right now saying, yeah, it hasn't changed all that much. So you're drafted into the regular Army. I mean, this is not the Army Air Corps yet.
No, that was the regular Army.
What was your welcome to the Army moment there at Camp Roberts?
It had rained for at least a week. We got off of this old troop train. Union Pacific had put it together out of some salvage yard somewhere in Texas or Oklahoma and dragged us out there. We got off the train and the mud was more than ankle deep. They had just finished building most of the barracks, not all, and none of the roads or sidewalks or anything. They had little wooden platforms from one barracks to the next, out to the mess hall. There was no parade field or anything at Camp Roberts at the time I got there.
And how'd they treat you? I mean, you're a tough farm kid who's been milking cows and stacking hay and dealing with all that. Did they still have some toughening up to do of you? Or how challenging were those training days?
It was no challenge to me. I was very familiar with a military rifle. They gave us one of those. I got along fine.
I'm just going to take a wild guess here. Is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
By that time, I was down Camp San Luis Obispo, and I was riding a motorcycle, escorting convoys and military vehicles about the base and up and down Highway 101.
There's some fun little curves on that road to be on a motorcycle for, right?
Oh, I could drag the footboards on most of them.
I believe it, knowing your background. Well, tell me about that date of infamy, December 7th, 1941. You're already in uniform, so I imagine that added to your perspective that day. But how'd you find out? What happened?
Had worked town patrol the night before in San Luis Obispo and didn't get in until 1 or 2 o'clock, so I was entitled to sleep in. However, somebody came in and threw a bandolier of ammunition right on me on the bed and said, "Get up, we're in war." I got a bite to eat. I escorted some officer that had driven into the base, and I escorted him down to where that Japanese submarine shelled.
This is by Santa Barbara, Point Magoo, right around there?
That's right.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that a Japanese submarine surfaced and shelled in that Santa Barbara area, but that was my question for you. As you get this news, and I don't want to lose track of your story here, escorting the guy down there, but was there a concern among the guys you were with that, hey, the Japanese are coming here to California?
It was a concern. We carried loaded guns, which were not very effective, but we did. I escorted this major down, and he dug that round, the projectile, that didn't explode. He dug it out and put it in the back of his government little Plymouth sedan and took it off to somewhere else.
So you are actually there while he's doing this? He grabs a round from a Japanese submarine that landed on U.S. soil on the West Coast. You saw him carry it off?
Definitely. He just put it in the back of that Plymouth station wagon, let it roll around in there. He wasn't excited about it going off.
That had to be kind of surreal for you. It's not just at Pearl Harbor. This is California, and you're seeing that a Japanese shell landed right there.
Oh, I was there.
Was that eye-opening for you to witness that?
Oh, yes. But everything was new. California was new. All those things were new at that time.
Well, I mean, just imagining if I were there, and, you know, we have the hindsight. We have the 2020 hindsight. Now we know what happened. But in that moment, if you know a Japanese sub was there, there's shells that have been fired, you probably think there's more coming, right?
I'm not sure what I thought. You can see that it was daylight. They had fired the shells in when it was dark. I'm not aware of anybody that panicked about the fact that they had done it. They did it, so what?
What about when you heard about the devastation on Oahu and 2,400 Americans have been killed in these surprise attacks by Japan? What kind of emotions or reaction did that stir in you?
I think everybody slipped the safety off of the 45. But other than that, all we had to do was, you're in the military, let's line up, get aboard.
Well, and I'm just hearing your story about racing motorcycles on dirt tracks in eastern Kansas. I'm thinking, hey, if you stayed in the Army, maybe you could have been pulling those Steve McQueen tricks in The Great Escape or something like that. Although you're more likely to end up in one of those POW camps as an airman, which you became. What was the point where you said, no, I want to get into the Army Air Corps and I want to be up in one of those planes?
When I was first drafted into the military, I wanted to get into Army Air Corps every chance I got, but they didn't open up the opportunities until after Pearl Harbor. Then I stood in line. There were five of us. Four of the people that rode motorcycles become either pilots or navigators. So in mass, we went from motorcycles to aircraft.
So they had to find a bunch more guys for motorcycles, I guess. But was your ambition, was your thinking in joining the Army Air Corps that you would become a pilot? Was that your goal?
Oh, yes.
How'd that work out for you?
Well, I was at King City, California. I was the first cadet back one morning. I had only about 17 hours of flying time. And as I turned final, we had no radios now. You just got the green light. I got the green light. And at the same time, an airplane was taking off. But I didn't see him. Remember now at King City, we had a big open area that we landed on or took off from, and we had a runway. Well, this other aircraft was a single-engine BT-13 trainer, a Vultee vibrator. When the tower gave the green light, I thought I was cleared to land, and he thought he was cleared to take off, so he gave me a lot of prop washing. The result was I dragged a wingtip, and if you made any mistakes at all, you became a navigator or a bombardier, because they had so many pilot applications and so few for a navigator or a bombardier. So that's how I become a bombardier.
And what were you in, a steerman or what?
That was an old Ryan PT-22.
They have a distinct sound, too, when you hear one of those Ryans in the air.
Oh, yes.
Well, that had to be disappointing for you, because here it seems like something outside of your control that caused that snafu for you, and now you don't get to be a pilot anymore. How did you feel about that?
First of all, that's wartime. I couldn't do anything about it. So you could cry, or you could get down. And I had a chance at navigator or bombardier because I had qualified. When we first became cadets, we were given a classification, qualified for pilot, navigator, or bombardier. You got a 1 to 9, and I got 9 on all three. So I said, bombardier is the quickest. It only takes about 14 weeks or something like that. So I became a bombardier. And then I became a bombardier instructor.
All before you went overseas? You were instructing before you went over?
At Albuquerque.
Kirtland Air Force Base now, huh?
That's right.
We have folks listening today in Albuquerque, too. And I know that was a big spot for bomber instructors. Was there anything about being a bombardier that you felt was particularly challenging or maybe distinctive or important to understand about that role?
Not necessarily. I could have been a navigator, too. I later went through navigation school after the war. But that's the quickest one to finish training and get out of here.
So what kind of bombers were you instructing in?
When I was an instructor, we just used twin beach turners. I think each cadet got to drop about 90 bombs, and they were all scored on how close they could bomb to the target, because they were all photographed.
So is that something where you'd go up with them on those training missions and critique what they were doing?
Oh, yes.
The bombs they're dropping, were they sacks of flour or what were they?
They were blue whistlers, 100-pound bomb. If you go over here to the museum, there are a couple of them sitting alongside the wall.
You're talking about the Warhawk Air Museum right here in Nampa, one of the finest air museums around, where you celebrated your 100th birthday not too long ago. So your time in Albuquerque there, correct me if I'm wrong. Again, I'm just flying blind here, but I'm guessing you probably could have stayed in that role as an instructor for as long as you wanted to.
I could have stayed longer, but a friend of mine was having trouble. His main trouble was probably the bottle, but he convinced me that we should go to B-26s down in Florida, MacDill Field, because his home was in Florida.
Had you heard anything about the B-26s?
It hadn't been good. There's been a Truman Commission that condemned them, and then the Jimmy Doolittle story got out, and the panic was over. That might be a good story for you to chase down sometime. The Truman Commission made all that fuss about the Martin B-26.
Yeah, they called it the Martin murderer or the flying prostitute, a plane a day in Tampa Bay.
Oh, yeah.
This Truman Commission says this plane's not safe to fly. We're losing too many American servicemen before they even get overseas, just in training.
That's right. But Doolittle had been in World War I. He'd been trained for it, but didn't fly. He was an acrobatic pilot and a stunt pilot and everything, and a test pilot and all that. He volunteered to fly one for the Truman Commission to see how it flew. And he feathered one. It had a reputation that you couldn't turn into the dead engine. But he took one up and did everything with it. Turned into the dead engine, rolled it, did all kind of acrobatics with this airplane. And then he testified before Truman that it was altogether the way you have been training the people. You've got to train them to fly this airplane because it is a good airplane if it's flown right. And he showed them. And the morale above cadets and young officers just went way up.
And some people listening might not really be familiar with the B-26 because so much attention is paid to the bigger bombers, the B-17, the B-24, later the B-29. For someone who has never seen a B-26, describe that aircraft for us.
It's a twin-engine, mid-wing, round fuselage, a single vertical tail.
And how about the crew?
The full crew was 7 men. And it carried, for power, the Pratt & Whitney R2800 engine and a Curtiss-Wright propellers. The engines had so much power, the original Curtiss Electric propellers only carried a 12-volt system. As you would accelerate on takeoff, the propeller has to change pitch as the forward travel of the airplane permits the propeller to overspeed unless it changes pitch. And the original Curtiss-Wright had a 12-volt system. And 12 volts wasn't enough power to keep up with the takeoff power of the Pratt & Whitney engine. As a result, the engine could overspeed the propeller, and of course that overspeeds the engine, and you lose forward power if your propeller isn't pulling you forward, and it's just churning around out there, so the aircraft loses power on that engine. You can't control an aircraft on single engine at 60 or 70 miles an hour with a rudder. It won't do it. So they were losing the airplanes due to the 12-volt systems were overpowered. When they put a 24-volt system on, problem solved.
At a cost of a lot of American lives, and that's right. What a lot of people don't understand about this time is how many people died domestically before they ever got overseas because no one had ever done this before. You guys were learning on the fly. I've got to ask you, once you made that move down there to MacDill and were training with the B-26s, did you have to deal with the loss of guys you knew?
Yes, our squadron commander was killed. Within a week of the time I arrived down there, we lost a couple airplanes while I was there.
I can't imagine that's very encouraging. If you're thinking about flying this plane into combat and with people shooting at you and all those hazards, I mean, if you can't even, you know, keep it safe in Tampa Bay, how are you going to survive overseas?
They changed to the 24-volt system soon after I got there. I flew a few missions out of Tampa, and I was only there about 5 weeks or something like that until I went over to Lakeland. At Lakeland, we had a completely different attitude of everybody. Doolittle's people had trained at Lakeland. A year before I got there, there were still some of the people around, and they were crazy about the airplanes. Our maintenance people were much more experienced. The confidence was there. The biggest problem we had was alligators in downtown Lakeland.
Is there a personal encounter you had there you want to tell me about?
No, but it was common knowledge that afternoon the police officers would carry a cane. And what do you think they carried a cane for?
To whack the alligator snouts or what?
They'd just threaten the alligator. And they had one they called Old Bull. And he'd come out right on the main drag and sun himself. The cop would have to come along. And if he had that cane, why, the alligator'd leave. He'd go back in the water.
Something tells me that is not the hazard you expected to hear about from a man who flew 46 missions as a B-26 bombardier in Europe. We'll hear about some of those missions when we come back with 100-year-old George Eldridge of Nampa, Idaho, right after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with an amazing 100-year-old who spent more than a quarter of those years in our armed forces, retiring from the Air Force as a colonel in 1969. George Eldridge lives in Nampa, Idaho now, but 73 years ago he was heading overseas to serve as a B-26 Marauder Bombardier with the 344th Bomb Group.
I went overseas on a Saturnia, which was a Italian luxury liner, in January 44.
So you end up in England, and how soon were you flying missions?
Probably 3 days after I arrived, because the pilots and the navigator had flown the airplanes over, and I went over on the Saturnia, so I was a little late getting there.
So they were ready and waiting for you to fly your first mission as a bombardier in a B-26. What do you remember about that first mission?
It was only about an hour and 40 minutes, no flight. No excitement. Climb out to 12 or 13,000 feet in formation, headed across the channel. And the first one, I didn't see any flak, but it wasn't long till I'd seen flak. And that's just a greasy fireball. It's red at first, but it's a greasy black ball in the air, and all kinds of little things falling off of it.
Yeah, you said it wasn't long till you saw flak. I know it also wasn't too long till you felt flak in your face, and we're going to hear that story. But some people, if they haven't learned much about this, they might say, well, if there's a puff of greasy smoke out there, just fly around it. That's not an option, is it?
No, it's so close, you're not going to fly around it.
And plus, you guys are flying in formation, right? So you have to keep formation. And maybe you should explain for folks, too, with the layout of that B-26, where you would be positioned as the bombardier and what your duties were.
I'm right in the nose of my navigator, because we were always a lead crew. I had a navigator as well as a bombardier. But there were two of us in there, and he was over 6 foot tall. And you can imagine how small that was.
So you guys were rubbing elbows literally in there?
Oh, yes. We were very close.
And you mentioned being a lead crew. That's a lot of responsibility. So that whole formation or the whole squadron, they're following your lead?
They drop when we drop, too. The pilots had to fly so the other pilots could stay with them, then we had to find and hit the target.
And how'd you do that? What kind of equipment did you have to locate the target?
Two eyes. We flew entirely by pilotage. Once we found what's called the initial point, and then you have another point so that you have time to align the formation and all that before you make your final turn on the target, because you don't like to have the flak tracking you for a long period of time. So you make turns. That upsets the flak gunners. If we did it properly, we could have a 30-second bomb run. The last 30 seconds, we'd open the bomb bay doors.
What kind of altitude were you typically dropping those bombs from?
Between 12 and 15,000.
What's the atmosphere or temperature or conditions of your cabin of that B-26 at that altitude?
It's not pressurized. You're at the mercy of the weather.
Brr. How cold did it get, you think?
It might be 10 below.
Do you have a heated suit or anything, or just some wool to keep your neck warm?
We usually wore long underwear. That'll do more than anything else to keep you warm.
How many missions did you end up completing with that squadron?
46 or something like that.
That's a lot of missions. I'm sure that there's more than one close call along the course of those 46 missions. Are there some that stand out for you, moments where came pretty close to claiming your life, or you weren't sure, or you saw the plane next to you go down? Are there some of those memories that still stick with you?
One of the ones I remember the most was the most fouled up. It was after we had moved to Belgium, and the ground forces now were well into Germany. We were way up into Belgium where the Germans had been. We took the airbase over from the Germans. We had taken off with 12 airplanes. We were up about 12,000 feet, dodging clouds, and called bomber control and told them where we were, and we were down to 6 airplanes is all we had. And somebody in bomber control had an open mic and said, "Pass the coffee." And someone else said, "Complete your mission is briefed." And we're fighting above 12,000 feet, no oxygen, cold, and only 6 airplanes by this time. We got a little break in the weather, and the target was the bridge on the same spot that the ground forces crossed on. We were to hit the approach on the north end of that bridge, so the ground forces would slow the Germans down, so the ground forces were there in about 100 miles there at the time and moving quite fast. So we went in, and we were above 19,000 with no oxygen, and we'd been up there for 2.5-3 hours, so we're not very smart.
You've got to be lightheaded and almost feel like you're going to pass out or something.
Well, it's not a good feeling. Anyhow, everything is, I've got the bomb site set up, opened the bomb bay doors so they could open our doors before time to drop bombs. In the confusion, we were actually in a G-model airplane, which was new to us, and especially new to my navigator. And I had opened the bomb bay doors, and he thought I had missed it, and he reached over and hit the switch, and the switch is up or down, open or closed. It was up for open, and he pushed it down, so I opened the bomb bay doors. The other airplanes opened theirs, and then my doors closed. And some of them, one or two of them, closed their doors and others didn't. And then my bomb bay doors opened real quick and out the bombs come. So my navigator, he took credit for that. The result was, as we turned off the target, we scattered bombs halfway to the North Pole. The first bombs I dropped, 4, I think, went on the bridge, and the rest went out toward Poland or somewhere like that.
Well, you and your pilot, Tom Johnson, both received the Distinguished Flying Cross for that mission. Half of the 12 planes, as you said, had turned back because that weather was just so bad, and your guy's response was to avoid the clouds by climbing to an even more dangerous altitude, 19,000 feet. Sure sounds like that DFC was more than deserved, and we still need to get eventually to the mission where you earn the Purple Heart, but I've got to hit the rewind button because there was a mission before the one you just described that I'm sure people would like to hear about. June 6th of 44, Everybody knows about what was happening on the beaches that day, but you were up in the skies above those beaches or above Europe that day. And you were one of the first planes to bomb, as I understand. What happened on that June 6th D-Day mission?
You have to go back to a couple of days before. The pilot I flew with and a couple of his buddies had gone to London. The wing commander called in all the navigators and bombardiers. He briefed us on it and put us in pairs. You do this, so you have to do this. You stay together until this mission is over. But the pilots were still in London, so they were a little late to get to the briefing. But they did make it, and Colonel Vance called us in the day before. He paired us off. You two will stay together. You two, you two, you two, you two. If one goes to the bathroom, you both go. You will not tell anybody, not any other crew members. Any of the pilots ask you, because there were none of the pilots at that briefing. They were just navigators and bombardiers. You don't say a word. If you have to, just turn and walk away. So I want to be absolutely sure there are no discussions of this mission before we are assembled at the briefing room. That's the first time you will hear anybody other than myself talk about this mission.
And that's not typical, right? So you're getting the sense that this is secret, that they're worried about spies or somebody finding out what's going to happen.
That's right. The navigator and I knew what the timing was going to be. The rest of the crews didn't know until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. The orderly come around, woke everybody up. So we had to go to the briefing room, and we took off right afterwards. And it was raining just like cats and dogs. As we went down the runway, the airplane just seemed to surge as it went over each puddle of water. And of course, that was 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock.
So what did you see as you flew over the English Channel toward France?
We were above an overcast. It was a severe, heavy rain. We joined up and there was enough light you could see the heavy rain here or there. June, the sun comes up rather early, so we could see, had a little light to dodge heavy clouds. I think we never got above 9,000 feet, and I think we bombed at about 7,000 or less.
And what was your target? Where did you guys drop those bombs?
On the beach. We were the first airplanes in. I was the second airplane in.
Can you describe that scene for us? I mean, this is a historic day, the longest day, a day that there's probably been more written about or talked about than just about any other day in history. So you're one of the first planes in, as you said. What did you see down there?
Just the coast. There was nothing unusual about the coast. That we'd seen the coast so many times and seen so many pictures of it. We knew exactly where the Germans were using the old French forts. The defense forts had been built soon after Napoleon, I guess.
So you're dropping bombs on these beaches and the cliffs where, in the hours ahead, those American forces are going to be storming ashore. But you're bombing before the troops got there? Is that what you're saying?
Before. We went in, I don't know how much, an hour or so before. We softened up parts of the beach anyhow. However, some of those troops didn't. The National Guard troops from Council Grove, Kansas, were in that original ground forces on that beach. They got slaughtered there. I went back 2 or 3 days later when the weather was a little better. We only had 12 or 15 of these bombs in our inventory, the 2,000-pounders. Now, a 2,000-pounder is about as long as from here to the wall over there.
6 or 8 feet long and 2 feet wide?
Yeah.
And we carried two in each airplane, and we only had 6 airplanes. The rest of the crews carried 500-pounders, but the 2,000-pounders were in just 6 airplanes out of my squadron. The beach didn't have any problem after that. The ground forces didn't have any trouble.
Because of those 2,000-pound bombs you dropped?
Yes. The wing commander was invited to the beach. A couple of weeks later, he went down to the 4th and 5th floor down in that fort, and the imprint of some of the German soldiers were still on the wall. The whole profile of the man was still there.
Because the bomb had detonated and basically left that silhouette on the wall.
That's right.
Did you have a sense of how significant this was, what you guys were doing? I mean, because that day was such a turning point. So many lives were lost, but you were a part of something historic there.
We'd been on, by that time, it was my 21st mission. So I was a little battle-hardened to some of those things. We knew that the Navy and the ground forces were out there and all what they had to do, because the buildup had been so definitely in England. Just you're in it. It's your time.
And I don't want to oversimplify, and I don't want to embellish, but it sounds like what you're saying, when you went back to Normandy and you dropped those bombs, that the effect that those bombs had on the enemy was such that it saved a lot of American lives.
Oh, yes. We had been in England about 3 months by that time, and we had seen signs of bombing in London and elsewhere in England. So the effect of war was, we were fairly well warned what it would be like, because the English had survived from the Luftwaffe for so many years.
You mentioned being desensitized to it, or hardened, or getting used to it. But was there ever a time where you felt, I'm not sure if I'm ever going to get back to the States? I don't know if I'm going to survive this war?
I didn't, but a number of people did. We had one navigator. He was a southern boy. He would carry gin in his canteen. And on the way back from a target, he'd get so soused, but his pilot wouldn't let him drink on the way to the target. But his pilot said he could follow other airplanes and come home anyhow without him.
Was there something that you think gave you confidence that you'd come home? Something that made you believe, you know, I'm not going to die out here, I'm going to make it back?
I don't know. The British had been through it so many years that any time you had contact with them, you yonks, you're chicken.
Well, I could see how that would refocus you. You know, you mentioned flak, and I'm sure you saw a lot of flak, and you had to fly through flak. What about fighters? Did your B-26s ever have to deal with German fighters?
My unit never did. I've seen them. I tried to shoot one down once, but he wouldn't come close enough. He was letting down after the invasion. He was east of Paris, over toward Lyon, and he had the gear and flaps down. Here he is with his gear and flaps down, coming out of a cloud, just 600 feet from me, and I can't get that 50 caliber over there. I hollered at the gunner, the turret gunner on top, the top gunner, and he got the turret around and fired a couple rounds at him, but the fellow pulled his gear up and went back into the clouds. But can you imagine his story when he gets down to the officers' club that night? That he's been out chasing B-17s, and here he is, all ready to head in, done for the day. Puts the gear and flaps down, and he's coming down through the clouds with his 109. All of a sudden, he lands on top of a bunch of Marauders. I'd like to know where that German is today.
Wouldn't that be something if he were still around, if he survived the war in the 72 years since? George Eldridge sure has, going strong at age 100. When we come back, we'll hear about the mission for which he received the Purple Heart. Check out the photos of George at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chat with an incredibly sharp 100-year-old named George Eldridge. Originally from Alma, Kansas, he's lived for almost 50 years now in Nampa, Idaho. But during World War II, he was crammed into the nose of B-26 Marauders in the skies over Europe. We heard about one of the missions for which he received the Distinguished Flying Cross, but now we need to hear about how you earned that Purple Heart.
We were chasing those V-1 launch sites called no-balls. I don't know why they called them no-balls, but they were called no-ball sites.
So you had been briefed on where these sites might be, and you were supposed to go find them and drop bombs on them.
Oh, yes. We knew where they were. We just finished the bomb run. We'd gotten some pretty close. A piece of flak had hit my pilot, the aircraft commander, in the chest, but he had the flak suit on, and so he got the piece of flak. And in the process, the plexiglass window was shattered. That's when I got peace in here.
You're describing that like it's no big deal or it's matter of fact, but when you're cramped into the nose of this B-26 and all of a sudden flak comes through that plexiglass and shatters it and goes everywhere, I imagine that's got to be loud. It's got to be chaotic. I mean, what was that moment like?
It doesn't happen. It's just instantly. It's over.
So you see the piece of flak that hit your pilot's flak suit, but you don't realize that something got you in the cheek?
No. A little bit of blood came down, and Carl says, "Hey, you've got a piece of flak on your face." And he reached over and pulled it out, and it was just a little sliver. Uh-huh. And I said, "Just hold on. You've got one," and it had pinned his eyelid down like this, that close to his eye. I pulled it out of his cheek right here.
And I'm thinking, how could you not feel that? Is it the cold of the altitude? Is it the adrenaline?
All three.
So you guys pull flak out of each other's faces and then put each other in for Purple Hearts or what?
That's up to the flight surgeon to do that.
Uh-huh. They did give you a Purple Heart for that. They also gave you the Distinguished Flying Cross more than once. Any other close calls you think we should know about?
There were always times when a flak gets, and you see one or two go down, you wonder about it.
That's not just a plane. Those are your buddies.
They're all in the whole airplane will go down. When the airplane gets hit in the engine and blows up, it pretty well, the whole airplane blows up because the tank probably goes off too. And it's just like that. They're there and then they're gone the next and it's way behind you.
But doesn't that tell you that you could be next?
No. You don't think that way.
What would you say was the hardest part or the most challenging aspect of flying all those missions in B-26s?
Probably the one when we went over to Rouen on the Rhine River and did nothing because one of the airplanes on the way back went down and only one man bailed out of it.
And you shared kind of how you got desensitized to the danger aspect or, you know, your own personal vulnerability. But how hard was it to deal with losing guys that you'd trained with or that you'd flown with or that, you know, you were around?
You just have to pack up their things, all of their belongings, and write letters to their family. The squadron commander has to do it, and all the crew members also had to do it if it was your crew member. And then in the case of many of your friends, you helped send letters back to the family.
That's something you had to do personally?
Oh, yes. And it had to have been handwritten. They couldn't be typed. I was in Belgium, but the squadron commander had left some things when we moved from England over to Belgium. He made arrangements that somebody would pick him up. And he said, because I was so close to coming home, and the war was just so close to over, he said, "You're going to pick up this stuff, and you got a C-47. And we were back at Stansted, so naturally I went to London. That was there in May of 45. You can't imagine how many glasses were broken and thrown out on the streets. Glass on the streets was just solid. I don't know how anybody walked on there. Nobody was barefoot, I'll tell you that. GIs with their girlfriends, or with any girl they could find, hanging out of every window on both sides of the streets all across London, and the British soldiers and airmen, they really got drunk.
Did you get to come home right after that, or were you stuck there for a while?
I came home in September.
You probably had a choice. Get out of the Army Air Corps or stay in?
At the time, I was squadron bombardier, and we had transitioned over to a new night bombing system called Shoran. There were only three or four of us, and we were to go down the southern route through India and up there, but we were to get Douglas B-26s. They'd call them A-26s. I had been flying Shoran missions over eastern France and got pretty good with that thing. It was very accurate.
How did it work?
It had two ground stations, a ground station here and a ground station here. Just how it would work, I don't really remember the details of it, but the two ground stations would put out a signal, and we were using an oscilloscope. We didn't use a radar. Just you know what an oscilloscope is?
Yeah.
A circular.
So the signals coming from those two ground stations allow you to triangulate the target.
It worked for real good. I could bomb quite accurate, and I had dropped quite a few bombs over in eastern France with it. Then another story off of it. Come the Korean War, I'm an instructor at Mather Air Force Base, and I get a phone call and then a message from Air Force headquarters that I'm directed to reinstitute a Shoran training program at Mather Air Force Base. The equipment was in storage, and I would install it so that we could have practice bombing into Beale. That's where the SR-71 flies now. We were to train out of Beale, and I set that whole program up before the Korean War got started, and we trained many crews at Mather to fly Shoran.
And then they used it in Korea?
Oh, yes.
And you stayed in for a long time after that. 1969, you finally retired as a full colonel. What were some of the other highlights of your Air Force career?
I flew B-47s back and forth to England for 5 years.
During the Cold War?
Yeah.
See, here's one thing. We talk so much about what happened, what actually took place. We spend very little time talking about what could have happened or what almost happened. I imagine those years in the Cold War, if you're flying those stratajets, there was probably some tension there of, boy, this could get really ugly real fast.
It could, but I never was in anything. I had some friends flying B-47s out of Topeka, Kansas. I flew them out of Salina, Kansas. This one tells me a story. He's one of the airplanes that is an electronic countermeasure snooper. It goes in and catches the frequency and of all the surveillance, the Russians, all their radars, and records them, then plots their location. He was a co-pilot in the back seat. That he's out north of Murmansk, out in the international waters. He looks around. He's a co-pilot. It's a MiG, and it comes up and sets on his wingtip, pulls off his head and puts it back on. Get on ears. And so they go on international frequency. Definitely English-sounding voice says, "What are you doing, Yank?" And "We're over 12 miles off. What can I do for you?" And he says, "I tell you what you can do for me. I can't get a Seiko watch in my exchange. Would you buy me a Seiko watch? Would you send it to me?" "Well, sure. What's your address?" And he gave it to him. When he gets down home, he goes down and buys a Seiko watch and sends it to this address. And he gets a check back, and that's a good check.
How about that? I mean, the Cold War is maybe the most tense time in world history, being carried out by politicians and generals, but those guys who are wing-to-wing in the skies had a mutual respect for each other, it sounds like.
Oh, yes, definitely. The same thing with the Germans. Sure. Oh, yeah.
A couple other things that come to mind. You mentioned, you know, you're in pilot training in King City, and you're Ryan when the Volti-Vibrator comes up and drops you with prop wash and you get washed out. But that wasn't the end of your piloting dreams. How long ago did you become a licensed pilot?
46. I bought a Taylorcraft. I was stationed in Washington, D.C. Worked in the Pentagon. I flew it all over the country. A Taylorcraft is, do you know what it is? A little 65-horse engine. It'll cruise 90. A good airplane, really.
Kind of like riding a motorcycle in the sky, right?
Right. Then I traded it for a Swift. The Swift was a beautiful little airplane, except mine only had an 85-horse engine. That wasn't enough. Later at Salina, Kansas, I put a 150-horse engine in it, and it really made an airplane.
And when you got out of the Air Force, you became a commercial pilot here in Idaho?
Way back in when I was at the Pentagon. I applied and got a commercial license. During the 60s and 70s, I flew that Mooney all over the West Coast, carrying people, usually out of Caldwell.
One other thing comes to mind. You have 5 children, and a lot of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Am I guessing that you met your wife because of the Air Force?
Oh, she was a nurse at Mather Air Force Base.
Guess it's a good thing you're in the Air Force. Did you ever plan on living to 100?
I don't think anybody does. What is the alternate?
Exactly. Well, what was it like for your 100th birthday to have so many family and friends join you at the Warhawk Air Museum here in Nampa and have that big celebration?
You should have been there.
I'm sorry, and I didn't get an invitation.
Some of them, one of them, for instance, I hadn't seen in 4 or 5 or maybe more years. He starts telling about the time that he and I flew an airplane back from down in Reno and things like that.
And when's the last time you piloted an airplane?
Maybe a year ago, or I went up with a fellow in Caldwell. He was going up and wanted to fly instruments, and when you fly instruments, you've got to have somebody in the left seat, make sure you don't run into something else.
So you were 99 years old and piloting an airplane?
Probably.
You know any other 99-year-olds who've done that?
I'm sure there are.
How many airplanes have you personally built with your hands?
Say 3. You want to see a picture of one?
I'd love to, and I understand you're working on number 4?
Oh, yes.
When's it going to be done?
What are you doing next week?
With regard to World War II, you're one of 16 million Americans who were wearing uniforms. Your brother was another one of them. 406,000 Americans died, and some of those were your friends. What do you think those of us today who weren't alive then, what do we need to know and remember about World War II and what all you guys did?
There's so many things I could tell you, but the first thing I'd say is just keep your head. Kids say stay cool. Of all things, stay away from drugs. And alcohol isn't going to do you any good either. I have known so many people with such brilliant opportunities or abilities that have foolishly exploited themselves. That's all you're doing. You can do all the crazy things I did, riding rodeo horses, racing motorcycles and all that, but that won't damage you near as much as a weekend of drugs. Now, I don't know anything about drugs other than to stay away.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Is there something that you would say that you're most proud of as you look back now at 100 years?
I'd say I resisted all those.
That you lived a clean life?
Not that been exactly clean, but but I resisted narcotics and all that stuff.
Anything else you think we should know?
Other than when's lunch and who's buying.
All right. Fair enough. That sense of humor has been honed for a century now. And hey, maybe if you're in Nampa, Idaho sometime, you can treat George Eldridge to lunch. Or better yet, meet up with him at the Warhawk Air Museum. That's our program for today. Find photos of Mr. Eldridge at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.